So here we are at the end of the season of Epiphany, and we're on the brink of heading off onto our journey into Lent. And I don't know about you, but my sense is the season of Epiphany passed fairly quickly this year. Remember that the feast of Epiphany, the day of Epiphany, is January 6th. It's a major church festival. It's rather like Christmas and Easter. It's that big. And the theme of Epiphany is about the recognition of God in the person of Jesus. Now, interestingly, the Eastern part of the Christian church focuses scripturally on the 6th by looking at the baptism of Jesus. While in the Western part of the church, we mark it by looking at the text, which is about the arrival of the Magi, the wise men. And both of those are kind of recognition stories. Epiphany is the season, however, that is only celebrated by a minority of churches. Most simply mark the festival of January 6th, the festival of Epiphany. But some of us actually choose to linger in that Epiphany season. We're one of those groups who were invited to do so. We don't have to, but we choose to. And so we started the season with the story of the Magi, and we're concluding it today. We heard the story in our Bible reading today. It's the transfiguration of Jesus. And that, too, is another kind of recognition story. And you can see it starts with the recognition of Jesus as both God and human. And through the weeks, we have been given insights into Jesus' identity. And we've spent some time looking for the metaphor of the light shining in the darkness. And there's more than a hint of that today, as we once again are looking at who this Jesus might be. The Transfiguration is a most otherworldly and shiny event. It's the strange vision that some of the disciples experience of Jesus communing with two of the other great figures of the Jewish faith, Elijah and Moses. And so let's look at that story again. Now Mark tells the Transfiguration story in a particular way. In the previous chapter, in Mark chapter 8, Jesus has continued to amaze the people with great works of power. He does that a lot in Mark. And he's fed a multitude. He's healed someone who was blind. Peter has also identified him as someone who is the Messiah in chapter 8. And that identification, that recognition of Jesus, is followed by Jesus' prophecy about his own death and resurrection. And the disciples are saying, so what's with that? I thought he was supposed to be the Messiah. And that just didn't make sense to any of the people who were listening to him. And remember, Peter objects. And of course, Jesus rebukes him. He actually comes down pretty hard on Peter. And then that chapter concludes with that quite enigmatic statement about how those who follow him will be required to pick up their crosses, and something about losing your life to save your life. And again, Mark's pace through this, all his action and these enigmatic remarks have the disciples' heads just a spinning, which is typical through Mark. One of the hallmarks of that particular gospel is the disciples never really get it. They're always confused as to what's going on, which gives me hope. Now we're into chapter 9. 6 days pass, and they are still in Gentile territory. They're not quite back on their home turf yet. And Jesus leads his inner circle, Peter, James, and John, leads them up a high mountain. Now, if there's one thing we know about mountains in the Bible, it's that it's on mountains that God so often chooses to communicate with people. It happens quite regularly. And that's sometimes a bit troubling. I remember, wasn't it also on the mountaintop that Abraham was asked to kill his son? You might want to file that odd little parallel story away. Keep that in your thoughts as we read through this. See, we've got mountains and meeting with God, and we discussed last week something similar in the subject of prayer. When you meet with God, it can be risky. And sure enough, I mean, Abraham knew that, didn't he? And when our group today are up on this mountain, something essentially indescribable happens. Something that's beyond human description takes place. We read that Jesus is transfigured. Now, if you're like me, this notion of transfigure is an unusual one. Transfigure is not a word that I drop too often into my everyday speech. In fact, I honestly cannot think of one time I've ever used the word transfigure outside of a church setting. You can try it, though. See if you can work it in this week somewhere. I dare you. Just to make sure we're on the same page, transfigure is defined as meaning to change the appearance of someone or something. To change the appearance of someone or something. And so Peter and James and John, they see Jesus' appearance change. They see him quite differently. And Mark writes that Jesus' clothes become exceedingly, blindingly white. They become brighter than anyone on earth could possibly brighten them. And I like the way in some translations it's as whiter than could be bleached. And you got to know that there's some ad agency somewhere that is being tempted to use this story to sell a cleaning product. You know, it's gone through someone's fevered imagination at some point because it's so perfect. I have this picture of this hapless husband leaning over a washer and he's calling out, "What's with this Transfiguro stuff, Madge? You know, one cup or two?" Maybe that's a bit of a reach, but what happens is that Jesus looks radically, radically different. He appears to shine to his followers. And to make this mysterious and jaw-dropping scene even more powerful, more head-spinning, Jesus appears there with two biblical figures. These are the two most revered characters in Jewish thought. Two other people who also had important meetings with God on mountaintops. Elijah and Moses. I have precisely no idea how Peter, James, and John would recognize Elijah and Moses. I would doubt that there would be many pictures of them around. But it seems they knew exactly who they were. Yeah, it's Moses and Elijah. And here, look, Jesus is talking to them. And then Peter, and you know it had to be Peter, right? Peter speaks to Jesus. He joins in this divine, this holy conversation. It just never seems to occur to him to hold back. Maybe this would be a good time to simply observe Peter. But then as a favorite New Testament scholar of mine, Ben Witherington, observes, there are those who have something to say, and there are those who have to say something. And Peter, he says, "Rabbi," and let's just stop there for a second. He says, "Rabbi." Remember, in the preceding chapter, he's identified Jesus as Messiah. But here he says, "Rabbi." You know, it's a word that means doctor or master or teacher. And that's kind of interesting. He was Messiah the week before, week before. And now he's back to being the rabbi. I wonder if Peter was just having trouble processing what he was seeing. And so he went with something safe. He says, "Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. This is one phenomenal moment. Hey, I've got an idea. Let's make three dwellings. We'll make three booths. What we'd probably say there. Let's make three monuments. One for each of you." And Mark actually notes that Peter was hanging on for dear life. He didn't really know what to say. It says that the three disciples were it's a Greek word, entromos. Entromos means terrified, that they were trembling. They were literally weak at the knees, trembling with fear. And this holy fear, this awe that comes from knowing that you're in the presence of something utterly extraordinary and wonderful, that's what they were experiencing. And then a cloud envelops the scene, and out of this fog and fog and cloud, it is usually metaphorical for some mystery. And certainly in the Bible, you'll see that clouds are often a sign of God's presence, of God's protection. Out of this cloud comes a voice. And the voice says something that's awfully reminiscent of what a similar voice said right at the beginning of Mark's Gospel, at Jesus' baptism. This voice says, "This is my son, my beloved. I really, really love him. So listen to him." And then it's done. Disciples no longer see the cloud. They don't see Elijah. They don't see Moses. They don't see the brightness. They just see plain old Jesus. Just Jesus. And then our reading ends with the four of them descending the mountain with orders that they are to kind of keep this one between themselves until the Son of Man had been raised from the dead. And here's Jesus going on about this death thing again. I mean, why does he keep talking about that? What's that about, they're saying? So it's a strange story. I have struggled with the story of the Transfiguration since the very first days I began preaching, which means I've had probably about 30 attempts at this text. And as I've wrestled with it, I've actually come to appreciate it. I've come to appreciate just how practical and important and how wholly relevant this wild story is. I mean, after all, this episode, it happens for whose benefit? It's not for Jesus, it's for the disciples' benefit. And therefore, it must be for our benefit. Which brings me to what we're doing here together this morning, which is worshiping together. I was reflecting on this week. Lots of holy moments have happened in this room. I think we had one of them on Friday. Holy moments. Admittedly, I don't remember Jesus being transfigured in front of us. I certainly don't remember him seeing him speak with Elijah or Moses. I don't remember a cloud descending amongst us. That may have been happening when I, wasn't here. Maybe it happens when Diane's preaching. But those are not things that I remember occurring. On the other hand, there have indeed been times when I think we've had some glimpses of Jesus, when we've had moments where, when words have failed us here, when in some different ways we've heard the voice of God and known that God's been very, very near. And you know, I find myself yearning for those times. I find myself wanting to capture them. I find myself rather like Peter. I want to hold on to them for just a bit longer. Because when they happen, it's oh so good to be here. And you told me about it too. I know it's not just me. Lots of holy moments have occurred in this room. And then, of course, afterwards, we have coffee, we greet one another, we make some new friends, we have some fruit bread, we head down the mountain. And that's how it works here. And that's how it works in countless other Christian gatherings around the world. And I find myself standing with Peter. I want what we experience here and in other places, those encounters with God, I don't really want them to stop. I want them to go on and on because it's wonderful, because it makes me feel alive in the most remarkable way. At the early worship service this morning, we sang a new tune called Alive Again. Alive Again. It's actually some of the words of St. Augustine are involved in it. And I was thinking, think about this, 1600 years ago, St. Augustine was saying, I feel alive now. That's worship. I was on a bit about this last week too. There's something about encountering God when it's when you know that, just know that God's in the house. And intellectually, I know that God's always in the house. But there are times when it just feels like Jesus is really near. It's like I can feel the breath of the Holy Spirit on my cheek. And times like that, they're just extraordinary. Words really fail to describe them. And you know, if it could only go on just a bit longer. But despite our best efforts, they don't go on longer. And no, it's not because we're weak. It's not because we aren't walking in the Spirit or we're spiritually immature. Though those things can factor in some way. No, we don't stay on the mountaintop because actually Jesus won't let us stay on the mountaintop. The disciples didn't head down the mountain into what would turn out to be another conflict with the church. Just keep reading to verse 14 of chapter 9. They don't come down the mountain because they're weak or immature in the faith. They come down the mountain because Jesus led them there. And ours is a faith that is played out against the backdrop of a fallen, conflicted, tumultuous world. Ours is a faith that is inevitably engaged in a struggle. It's engaged in conflict. It's involved in the nitty-gritty of human life. And at times, the nitty-gritty of human life is really, really hard. We head into Lent this Wednesday, what we call Ash Wednesday. And we know where the Lenten journey leads us. It takes us to a confrontation with the powers and the principalities. And we see that most graphically played out in front of us on Good Friday. It takes us to the cross. And we, as Jesus' friends, are invited to imperfectly follow him. And like the other disciples, we will probably do so from some distance. But follow we will. As I said, I love it when we worship together. I love it when we join together and metaphorically climb that mountain to experience some sort of encounter with God in all its mystery. And strangely enough, paradoxically, it's then that we know that there is so much we don't know. And it's so real. It's so real that I feel just a bit afraid. And then I get that little tremble and I'm remembering and reminded that God's God and I'm not. There's all sorts of danger here too. See, that kind of worship can become an end in itself. It can readily become all about me. It can be about my needs. And the next thing you know, I find myself saying, you know, I really didn't get anything out of worship today. I've heard that here. I've said that here. But when you stop to think about it, it's really an admission that I've lost the point. That I might actually be worshiping a false God. I might be worshiping me. The question in worship is always, did God get something out of it? That's the key. How did God think about worship today? But when we get that in the right order, worship is a pretty cool thing. There is, however, a requirement to come down from the mountain. Because Jesus has placed a call on us in worship. As he indicated in the passage before our text today, there's a cross to be taken up, there's a life to be saved in that taking up. And I actually think that we start down the mountain in our liturgy here, in the form of worship we offer. We regularly, throughout our worship time, confess our need for God. We do it all through our service. Our prayers are indeed prayers of praise and thanksgiving. Our songs are songs of praise and thanksgiving. Our offering is an offering of praise and thanksgiving. But underneath those things, there is also the stark awareness that we need, that we can't do it on our own, that we can't save ourselves, and that there is a whole world out there that can't save itself. And so our worship, when we're on, when we're on our mountaintop, it's not a disconnected thing. What it does is it actually draws us into the world. It helps us to actually see, it helps us to reveal the lie that we can do it on our own. That our own efforts can save us. And then it encourages us and it equips us and it strengthens us and it sends us. You see, what we do here is for them. Isn't that interesting? What we do here in worship is for them. What happened in the Transfiguration? I haven't the foggiest clue. But what I do know is that something happened. I know it's something that words fail to properly express. And I do know that we can't stay here. For you and I, we are being called out into the world. As we'll begin to see next Wednesday, there's a tough task ahead of us. There's going to be no small amount of opposition. Conflict is the reality of any disciple. Any congregation that truly attempts to follow after Jesus will know conflict. There are powers that do not want him to succeed. To worship Jesus requires that we follow Jesus. And so we go with him. And that will be enough. Amen.